The U.S. economy is improving. That word today from Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke, speaking before a congressional committee. But there are still areas of weakness, especially in the job market. Bernanke also said that with inflation tame, the Fed is likely to keep interest rates low for an extended period. And Bernanke's words sent stock prices rising. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
This was Bernanke's first trip to Capitol Hill since his reappointment battle last month, when he took heat over the way the Fed had handled the big bank bailout. This time, the atmosphere was less contentious. He appeared before the House Financial Services Committee to give his semi-annual assessment of economic conditions. Bernanke said the economy continues to improve. There was no talk of a double-dip recession.
Indeed, the U.S. economy expanded at about a 4% annual rate during the second half of last year.
But Bernanke said the rebound was due in part to what economists call an inventory correction. Businesses that let their supply of products dwindle during the downturn are now restocking their shelves. If the rebound is really to last, Bernanke said, consumers will have to start buying more.
A sustained recovery will depend on continued growth in private sector final demand for goods and services.
There already has been some pickup in consumer spending, he said, and business investment is up significantly. But demand won't really take off until the job market improves. And right now, it's still very weak. Bernanke said he's especially concerned about the growing number of people who remain unemployed for long periods.
Indeed, more than 40% of the unemployed have been out of work for 6 months or more, nearly double the share of a year ago.
And then there's the credit problem. Bernanke said big banks seem to be doing a lot better, but small businesses are having considerable trouble getting credit. Yet for all the problems he cited, Bernanke sounded, on the whole, surprisingly optimistic, says Mark Vittner, chief economist at Wells Fargo.
He seems to be fairly upbeat about what we're seeing in the manufacturing sector, even noting that the manufacturing sector is leading the economic recovery. But a little more downbeat about other parts of the economy, still acknowledging big problems in commercial real estate and ongoing struggles in the housing industry.
Bernanke spoke at length about the Fed's efforts to unwind some of the extraordinary measures it has taken to prop up the economy. Since last year, for instance, the Fed has been buying up mortgage-backed securities as a way of pumping money into the housing market. It will stop doing so next month. That's raised concern in some quarters that mortgage rates could rise, but it hasn't happened so far. And Bernanke said the Fed would be watching the situation carefully, but he suggested that the impact of the unwinding will probably be mild.
These adjustments are not expected to lead to tighter financial conditions for households and businesses and should not be interpreted as signaling any change in the outlook for monetary policy.
In fact, he said the Fed plans to keep the interest rates it controls at historically low levels for an extended period of time. It can do that because there's virtually no sign of inflation. Bernanke was asked several times about the growing federal budget deficit. At one point, he conceded that addressing the deficit would probably be good for the economy. Bond markets want to know that the trajectory of bigger and bigger deficits will end.
It would be very helpful, even to the current recovery, to markets' confidence, if there were a sustainable, credible plan for a fiscal exit, if you will.
But for the most part, he demurred. Early on, Committee Chairman Barney Frank asked whether concern about the deficit should trump all other government priorities, like passing another stimulus package, something many Democrats advocate. Bernanke dodged the question, saying only, "There are difficult trade-offs that have to be made." Jim Zaroli, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. A high school student is suing a suburban Philadelphia school district for allegedly spying on him through the webcam of a school-issued laptop. The allegation has infuriated many parents and spurred a criminal investigation by the FBI. From member station WHYY in Philadelphia, Elizabeth Fiedler reports.
The case that started with Mike and Ike candy and a laptop computer has become a national focus for concerns about technology and threats to privacy. Last week, 15-year-old Blake Robbins, a student at Harriton High School, filed a federal lawsuit accusing school officials of using the webcams in school-issued laptop computers to spy on him and potentially every other student in the district. According to the suit back in November, a school official accused Robbins of improper behavior in his home and cited as evidence a photo taken from the webcam on the student's computer. The student's attorney, Mark Haltzman, said the school believed a webcam picture caught the student handling pills.
They claimed he was selling drugs, and they were actually Mike and Ike's. And the assistant principal approached him and his parents about that and made allegations that they thought he was selling drugs.
Today, that assistant vice principal, Lynn Matsko, gave reporters a brief and emotional statement.
At no time have I ever monitored a student via a laptop webcam, nor have I ever authorized the monitoring of a student via security tracking webcam, either at school or within the home. And I never would.
Matsko did not take questions and did not directly address the discussion she is accused of having in the lawsuit. The Lower Merion School District admits it installed software that gave officials the ability to activate students' webcams at any time. But officials say they only used it to track down lost or stolen computers, and they've now stopped the practice. Last night, about 100 parents packed a school meeting, even though the laptop controversy was not on the agenda. But if they expected District Superintendent Christopher McGinley to talk about the lawsuit, they were disappointed.
It is our practice and desire to be as open as possible, but the fact is that we are simply unable to discuss laptop security.
Parents at the meeting seem to be split on the issue. Karen Gottlieb likes the school district, but she doesn't like the idea that it might have spied on her 10th grader.
The laptop was either on our kitchen table open as I cooked dinner, as my other child did his homework, as my husband came in the door and read the mail. It was open in her bedroom while she changed her clothes. She even brought it into the bathroom to listen to music on while she was showering.
Gottlieb's daughter now covers her webcam with a Band-Aid. Other parents say they're using tape and Post-it notes. Mayor Jadija's 17-year-old daughter, Dave Key, has one of the laptops. He's not worried about the school spying on her, but he has another concern about the case.
If it goes all the way to the Supreme Court, this is going to cost millions of dollars to the school district, and I'm the one who will be paying it. I think we, as the parents and students, should stand by school district to defend them.
Federal prosecutors and the FBI confirm they've launched a criminal investigation. For NPR News, I'm Elizabeth Fiedler in Philadelphia.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
I'm Melissa Block, and we begin this hour in the hot seat. Today was day two of congressional hearings into Toyota's recent safety problems. Lawmakers heard from the company's president and CEO, Akio Toyoda, who's also the grandson of the company's founder. Toyota apologized for accidents that have occurred because of defective cars. He also pledged to work, as he put it, unceasingly to restore the trust of customers. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
It was a moment of grand drama in the hearing room of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee as Akio Toyoda took his seat at the hearing table. While he's spoken to media outside the U.S., this was his first performance on the Washington stage, as his company recalls 8.5 million vehicles worldwide because of instances of sudden acceleration. Mr. Toyoda said the problem stemmed from the company's desire to become the world's largest automaker.
We pursued growth over the speed at which we are able to develop our people and our organization, and we should sincerely be mindful of that. I regret that this has resulted in the safety issue described in the recalls we face today.
Some 36 deaths have been attributed to sudden acceleration in the U.S. Toyota offered a personal apology to a California family who lost 4 members in a fiery crash near San Diego last August.
Especially, I would like to extend my condolences to the members of the Saylor family for the accident in San Diego. I would like to send my prayers again, and I will do everything in my power to ensure that such a tragedy never happens again.
For the most part, lawmakers received Toyota respectfully. Committee Chairman Adolphus Towns, a Democrat from New York, told Toyota his appearance shows his commitment to safety. But earlier, Towns had some stinging words for two popular Toyota models that have been recalled.
If the Camry and the Prius were airplanes, they would be grounded.
Florida Republican John Mica held up a document uncovered by congressional investigators in which the company bragged it had won a victory when the government recalled floor mats believed to cause unintended acceleration, but not the car itself, saving the company $100 million. Mica addressed the president of Toyota North America, Yoshimi Inaba.
Mr. Inaba, this is one of the most embarrassing documents I've ever seen. In your preparation of this, you embarrassed all the people I represent, those hardworking people across this country.
Inaba said while the document had been sent to him, he had only been on the job a few days, and it didn't represent his view.
It is so inconsistent with the guiding principle of Toyota and my feelings.
The role of the government in overseeing auto safety also came under examination. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood was questioned for 4 hours about the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, one criticism that former NHTSA staffers went to work for Toyota after leaving the agency.
What the law requires is that if you've been an employee at DOT and you go to work for a company that does work with DOT, you cannot communicate or participate in the work that you did with this company.
It's unclear what will result from today's hearing. Lawmakers alternated between blasting the company and praising it for the jobs Toyota has created. Akio Toyota, who said his name appears on each of the company's cars, can only hope his appearance will turn the page on what has been a public relations disaster for his company and a nightmare for many Toyota owners. Brian Naylor, NPR News, the Capitol.
Okay, normally when President Obama convenes a meeting, the TV cameras are allowed in for a moment at the start. Journalists get their video, they're escorted back out, and only later does the business begin. This morning, the cameras stay in the room. President Obama meets congressional leaders at a square table near the White House on live television. Democrats want to find a way to pass a massive health care overhaul. Republicans are making a coordinated push for a more gradual approach.
We need to set reducing health care costs as our goal and move step by step toward that goal to re-earn the trust of the American people.
What they really want us to do is do things step by step.
We ought to go step by step to work on the cost problem.
That's the Republican response, which does present some practical problems. Here's NPR's Scott Horsley.
Comprehensive anything is a tough sell in the Senate. Tennessee Republican Lamar Alexander and his colleagues want a more incremental approach to fixing health care. Alexander dismisses President Obama's proposal as ivory tower arrogance.
The White House seems to be obsessed with this idea that a bunch of professors sitting around a table can come up with a comprehensive bill and change one-seventh of the American economy all at once. We're not that smart. We don't do comprehensive that well.
Uwe Reinhardt admits to being a Princeton College professor. He's also one of the country's leading healthcare economists.
What's wrong with professors? They too can think, by the way, not only senators.
And Reinhardt has spent a lot of time thinking about healthcare. One proposal, popular with both Democrats and Republicans, would require insurance companies to provide coverage to anyone who wants it at a community rate, regardless of illness or pre-existing conditions. Reinhardt warns that idea would be problematic if adopted in isolation.
That will lead to a lot of young people not being insured when they're healthy, but throwing themselves on the mercy of the community rate when they get sick.
It would be like letting people buy homeowners insurance after their house is on fire. Premiums would soar, or insurance companies would go broke. To avoid that, Democrats would require almost everyone to carry health insurance, and they'd provide subsidies to poor people to help them pay for it. Reinhardt says those three components at the heart of the Democrats' plan are like three legs of a stool. They only function as a unit.
Once you start with community rating, you have to have the mandate, and once you have a mandate, you have to have subsidies. You cannot take those in step. You have to do all three things together.
That's why President Obama decided against a scaled-down plan, even after Democrats lost their supermajority in the Senate. The alternative Republican plan would not require insurance companies to cover everyone, but Senator Mitch McConnell says it would make modest changes in an effort to address high costs.
Things like junk lawsuits against doctors and hospitals, interstate insurance competition, things like small business health plans. Those are the kinds of things that target the cost issue, which the American people thought this was all about from the beginning.
The Congressional Budget Office estimates the GOP plan would expand coverage to about 3 million uninsured people, compared to an extra 30 million who'd be covered under the Democratic plan. Of course, President Obama himself opted for an incremental approach early on in the health care debate when he rejected calls for a single-payer system as too disruptive to the status quo. Vermont Congressman Peter Welch wants the president to reconsider, saying the government would avoid a lot of confusion and complexity by simply expanding Medicare to cover everyone.
This debate we've had here in Washington that's gone round and round has essentially been, in some ways, avoiding the obvious.
Welch argues that expanding Medicare would give consumers guaranteed health care and a choice of providers while sharply reducing administrative costs. But that's one health care overhaul that's too comprehensive, even for President Obama. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
By the end of this day, you can know everything you want to know about this televised meeting. You can go to NPR.org throughout the day for live blogging of the event and join us online and on many NPR member stations at 7 Eastern tonight for a special one-hour wrap-up.
More turmoil for the Netherlands. This time it has to do with the national sport of speed skating. The controversy follows a huge, inexplicable mistake last night at the Winter Olympics in Vancouver. The Dutch skating star Sven Kramer was well on his way to winning a sure gold medal in the men's 10,000-meter event when his coach shouted at him to switch lanes. That was the mistake. Kramer crossed the finish line in what would have been an Olympic record time, raised his arms in triumph. Then his coach had to tell him he'd been disqualified for an illegal lane change. Jaap de Groot was there watching in disbelief in Vancouver. He's chief sports editor for the Dutch newspaper The Telegraph. And Mr. de Groot, why don't you describe the reaction inside the Oval last night? The stands were packed with Dutch fans in orange watching.
Yeah, it was happening halfway the race when it appeared that Sven Kramer was just heading for a second Olympic gold. The whole stadium was euphoric. You know, it was an unbelievable atmosphere. And when he made a mistake, I think only a couple of people realized it. I think it took about 1 or 2 minutes until the rest of the crowd understood what was going on. And while he was skating, he felt that, you know, the noise went down, and all of a sudden he was skating as a champion, but in complete silent surroundings. And he told later that that aspect made him realize that something was wrong.
Now, you said he made the mistake, Sven Kramer, but really it was his coach, right? Gerard Kemkers, who told him, change lanes, and that was the mistake.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. His coach had a complete blackout.
What happened? How did that happen?
He just made a mistake. He thought he had to go to the inner lane instead of the outer lane. And then he panicked and pointed his finger to the inner lane and shouted to Kramer to change his route.
This is really an unthinkable thing that happened there last night. And you could tell afterwards, Sven Kramer was furious. He threw his skating glasses down on the ice. He pushed his coach away. What did he say after the race?
Well, that was his first reaction. I must say that afterwards he acted like a real great sportsman, because when it went official to press conference, he more or less neutralized his opinion about his coach. He said, okay, he made a mistake, that's clear, and I lost the gold because of that, and people make mistakes, and he, unfortunately for me, he made a big one tonight.
What about Coach Kemkers? What happens now? After the race, he said, my world collapsed, this is the worst moment of my career. Does he go into hiding now in the Netherlands?
No, on the contrary. Georg Kemkers earlier today gave a press conference saying that he had a bad night, stood up this morning and decided to close a chapter and just leave it behind and continue with his work. And I think he underestimates the reactions in Holland, because the reactions were furious on the public. And I must say, I just spoke to Sven. He's very easy on this. And the only thing he wants to do now is getting on Saturday with a team pursuit another gold medal. And I think after Saturday, things will become serious between him and his team and his coach.
Become serious? What do you mean?
Yeah, well, I think this is not just a mistake. Sven Kramer is for years been focused on getting at least 3 gold medals at this Olympics. Now he's now going to get a maximum of 2. I think this will be continued after the Games.
And you think the coach will be gone, basically?
I wouldn't be surprised. I think this is a historic mistake. I think in Holland, over 50 years, we will still remember this mistake.
Jaap de Groot, thanks very much for talking with us about it.
Okay, it was a pleasure.
Jaap de Groot is chief sports editor for the Dutch newspaper The Telegraph. He spoke with us from Vancouver.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.